All right, so let's come to order. Tony might join us, but we can go ahead with our roll call. Jen Hedrick.
Here.
Katrina Bowles.
Here.
Bill Whitekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
Cody Darr.
Here.
Kim Kraus.
Here.
Greg Coffin.
Here.
I'm here. John Conway will not be here tonight, for sure. We need to approve the agenda. Does this look all right, or are there any additions, corrections, or proposed deletions?
Did we want to, I think one of those emails we got was your interim report.
Yes.
Did you want to talk about that?
Sure.
Okay. When did that go out?
Folders? I don't know. They are included the
meeting
agenda.
Sorry.
Oh, you do need them? Mm-hmm. Okay.
There you go.
Bring that to Bill as well.
You don't have an extra copy of the minutes.
I was going. I'm looking. I was emailed a copy of the minutes from the last one.
I did not receive that.
You didn't get that one?
They're way above.
I'm
pretty sure it is.
Can
we forward it to you? Yeah, please. You got open.
What are you forwarding? The interim report. Where'd you get it from?
So what'd it come from?
Carol Schaefer.
Oh, wait a minute.
On the 19th.
I probably do have that one. Here it is. I found it. Never mind.
Okay.
I stand corrected.
All right, anything else to do with tonight's agenda? Okay. Can we approve it as amended?
I motion to approve the minutes as
agenda
as amended.
Thank you.
Second.
Okay. Favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right, okay. Well, should we table these minutes until next time, or would you like to go ahead and discuss them? I can try and follow along on my phone.
It's up to you. I mean, I don't think it doesn't make a difference. I personally didn't see anything.
Okay. I'm comfortable trying to. I think we can do that. So Cody doesn't have any changes. Other comments?
I didn't have either. It was not present in one meeting, but when it was correct.
Just again, want to state, I guess, that for full minutes or for full details on what we discussed, anybody should probably refer to the recordings as opposed to the minutes.
Thank you. Right. And I will note that I'm meeting with Carol tomorrow at 8:30, but we did have a conversation about sort of updating our shared Google site, and I know that she's gone through and added several things to it from the last couple months of work, and we'll look it over tomorrow and see what we're missing. So that should be a full resource. Any other comments on the 9th? Mm-hmm. All right, if they look okay, can we have a recommendation for approval?
I'll make a motion we approve the
August 9th.
Minutes, yes.
Thank you.
Second.
Thank you. In favor?
Aye.
Let me get here to the 17th. All right. Comments, corrections? This talks about Mr. Teddy's presentation.
I There were some slight incomplete thoughts, I think, in his presentation or in the regurgitation or review of it, but I'm not so bothered by them that I'm wanting to change anything personally.
Okay, well, and I agree with you. I mean, I guess the one addition we might make is to refer to the recording.
Yes.
Okay, so let's amend the 17th minutes, new business number one, Tim Teddy presentation section, to add a sentence at the end that says something to the effect of, for full review, please listen to the recording on the Google shared document site.
That probably should be a blanket statement for each one of those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be nice to have.
Because
we
can't get all the discussion.
Yeah, it would be nice to have one each of the minutes.
Right. Okay, so with that amendment, are we ready for a motion to approve?
So moved.
Thank you.
Second.
Okay, in favor?
Aye.
All right, good job. One more thing in terms of just sort of a business announcement. I was asked to, and I hadn't noticed that we were doing this, but I'm sure it does appear on recordings quite clearly, that we just be careful to not talk over each other, that it makes listening to them and getting the minutes done hard. So I've announced that now. Okay. Okay, so our first agenda item tonight is discussion regarding Mr. Teddy's presentation. And particularly, I was thinking through where does that fit in terms of our reporting, and do you see any recommendations coming out of that conversation?
I think the scorecard mm-hmm. concept for me struck as something that we should champion, or at least recommend that they continue to pursue that. I think it brings value not only to the city and the citizens of Columbia, but also the development community, is getting more clarity on the viability of projects that they're getting ready to invest a lot of money in.
Greg, do you think that the scorecard should be numerically based, or more the way that Tim described it, which was a little bit more
narrative.
I think it needs some level of grading, but I don't think it needs a numerical score. You know, I think it maybe some level of acceptable, or you know, caution or whatever. They just have to come up with some kind of common grading system that at least gives them an idea where they stand. Like if it's a questionable development, they need to say questionable development, and then they need to look at it further. So.
So some sort of even nominal ratings as opposed to...
Yeah, I don't know that we need numbers, you know, like, you know, 78.3, but I mean, just...
Because what you run into with that is, how do you rank, you know, you got an 8 on the streets and a 6 on the sewer, like, how did they compare it?
Are
they weighted, like, how is the streets' importance related to you? You really get into, should it be a 25 out of 30 for streets and then an 8 out of 10 for sewer? You know, you just get into that, it would be tough, I think, if you... tried to have an all numerical based system. So just like you were saying, good, acceptable, satisfactory, marginal, you know, poor, you know,
or incomplete, or maybe not incomplete submission, though, where there's just not enough information to submit.
That's true.
Yeah.
To analyze it. So
I also appreciate his comment that it's a process to implement a scorecard.
Yes.
And you know, you first go through a process of norming, that people are understanding what the categories and the gradations mean.
So like after a year and maybe after 5 years, refine, you know, go back and revisit the scorecard and see what's been effective and what could use improvement, or what the community or applicants have liked, or what has been a concern or caused, you know, more confusion,
right.
You know.
I think it's, what do you think about the idea of some sort of regular schedule or trigger for review of a scorecard and other...
Well, I think that should be balanced in any system that it gets reevaluated over on some level of frequency.
Right.
It'd be tied into the citizen survey.
What kind?
Satisfaction survey.
The satisfaction survey?
Done at the same interval that's done.
Oh.
How often do we do that?
It's not every year.
Do we want to say it should be reviewed every year, or just say say it should be reviewed regularly at the director's discretion or at city staff's discretion or something? But we think it would be good to review it.
I'd prefer to be more ambiguous on that, because they might develop something that works quite well and you don't have to reinvent it every year if it's not necessary. But if it is, it could be. It doesn't have to be on a yearly. It could be any time it needs to be updated. But I would assume that they would have to take it back to council if they're not making any significant change.
I think this was meant to be an administrative type thing. I don't know. Maybe the first go-round would be in council. I kind of saw it as an administrative thing, as a uses reference tool. But if it's not going to be regulatory, if it's not going to be actionable, then it probably wouldn't need to be go to city council, especially at every review. It would just be an internal review. Maybe a city council ordinance or something saying, let's implement this for every project, or have a line on the staff report for every project that this is, even though I don't want it to be limited to just developments that go to city council where they have that, because there's other site plans and type of stuff that are administratively reviewed. So
it should be the sole decision maker, but I think we need to frame our recommendation from the aspects of infrastructure, because that's what we're, because it's got a lot of different values to it, but we just have to say from an infrastructure standpoint, it provides the community and the developer feedback on the viability of projects and will they work within the existing infrastructure, or will additional things need to happen in order to make their development work.
Right, which is why, and I don't think you're going to necessarily disagree with me on this, Cody, but I think there are really two sides to this. I mean, there is the administrative side of it in terms of sort of norming and standardizing what developers and people doing projects can anticipate when they start and go through their process. But I also think the flip side of that coin in normalizing is that it gives the community a chance to be on the same page and understanding how the process works. So some sort of public vetting or education around how a scorecard works is going to hopefully make things fairer and less contentious.
Yeah, I don't see anything.
Would it be transparent then, the scorecards?
Yeah, that's another question I have about it, is then how does the score, the scores on the scorecards become part of public record.
Right. I mean,
how is that reviewable? So I don't think we should presume to know the answer to that, but I think it would be useful to ask that question in our recommendations.
Another thing about his presentation that caught me, and it was towards the end, and I think that it seemed like there was a certain amount of communication and dialogue they have with the development community before a project actually becomes official, where they're actually requesting rezoning. And I understand that there's a certain amount of that has to happen in should that be formalized more than it is now? Because it seems pretty loose. Or, some developer may get better information than others depending on the availability of staff. It's almost like there needs to be some type of a pre-application that they could have at least a certain level of dialogue without going to the next level.
They do have. The concept review is there's no, you're not, nothing's set in stone. It's an informal meeting, and it is with all the city staff or departments and even other governmental agencies, that a proposed developer with his development or whatever it may be would submit some preliminary documents to the city, and then they schedule a meeting. And
so
they send out notices to anybody in a certain radius of that site saying a concept review is held for this site for a potential rezoning from R3 to C1 or something like that. And anybody that, and it's also in the newspapers, and people can go and see.
But that, what is that before the application process?
That's before the application. That's okay. Before any formal application. That's just a, this is an informative session that the city provides to the developer as an informative process, part of the process for them to know what they expect, broad strokes, before they get the fucking.
But once they've reached the sort of criteria of having ownership or ability to do a development.
That's only for a rezone.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Is that only if it's rezoned? So
it's for the only time it's required. Now, you can do it at any type of development. You can ask them to do it, and it might be worth your while if it's a complicated project. Mm-hmm. But the only times they're required are for annexations, rezonings, planned district zones, preliminary plats, the things that don't typically trigger the need for a concept review are site plans or commercial site plans on a straight zone site, like subject zone R3 or C1, they don't require it. And I don't know how the new development code will address that. Maybe they'll require some preliminary thing for that, those kind of site plans, but I don't really know exactly what they'll require. But right now, they don't require it for that. You just, if it's a site plan on a straight zone, you can just make your formal application for building permits without any kind of concept review. Also, for final plats that have already been preliminary platted, you can just submit those without a formal concept review or informal concept review.
A replat
would not trigger if it had already been to council, if it had already been to Planning and Zoning Commission. No, it does not trigger a concept review. Like a final minor plat, now that would trigger a concept review because it had not been previously looked at by Planning and Zoning Commission. It had not been previously preliminary platted, and it hadn't been vetted. So it would be.
It seems like there could be many different straight zoning projects where a project could have a significant impact on infrastructure.
Oh, yeah.
Downstream, upstream.
Like, no development downtown. I mean, that's all straight zoning.
Right.
It's required to have a concept review.
I mean, they might have asked for one, but.
Yeah, and it would probably be in their benefit a lot of times.
Do we, as a group, recommend that that should be a requirement for projects that would have an impact on infrastructure? Because you've got to start that conversation early. You can't wait till you file a building permit to realize that you're going to have a.
I don't know what service that would serve the cities. I mean, I definitely see the benefit from requiring it for the developer. For the city, they're going to make they're going to have objective criteria. The water department says, whether it's the preliminary stage or when they get the formal application, if you're short-sighted enough as a developer to just do all this work based on no informal concept review with the city, then you're kind of just submitting at your own risk, I feel like. So,
are concept reviews are public meetings? No.
I don't think the public is invited.
Okay.
Not to say that if somebody wanted to invite a member of the public, maybe. No.
But they're announced.
No, we would not invite them. You can bring whoever you want.
Yeah. They're not public. They're not like posted as public meetings or anything.
But they're announced to surrounding
after it's taken place.
After it's taken place.
Well, most of the developers that develop in Columbia or used to develop in Columbia, but in the last, you guys probably know more, but the last seems like 5 to 7 years we've had a lot of people coming from the outside and that may not be as familiar with the practices that Columbia has. You know, I didn't know that they do. They have a development handbook,
local
guidance,
local planners and civil engineers.
They hire
surveyors.
Local people, I guess, to I guess. Help them along. Yeah, because you have to, because otherwise you're going up a big learning curve.
Every municipality is like that. I mean, I would be lost if I tried to do a site plan in St. Louis or something. I wouldn't add very much value if they were looking at me to try to get them through a rezoning process, because even though I do that all the time here, mm-hmm. I'm sure it's completely different. Same principles, but like the process and procedures would be completely different in who you talk to and stuff, and that's what the concept review the planners, you know, you have a designated planner, and he says, you know, these are the submittal dates. You're going to have to go through a public information meeting, planning and zoning. You're going to have to go to council. This is the departments you need to talk to because you're talking about extending sewer or whatever. So it is very helpful.
A lot of times outside, if you come from outside, out of state, they hire a lawyer here. That helps the development process.
And at some point in time, hire an engineering or architectural firm to help them walk them.
Yep.
But that is a good question as far as prior to formal submittal. Do we want to require concept reviews, or do we think the city needs to see informal?
From an infrastructure standpoint, do you think that you're getting the information earlier enough, or do you need that concept? You need to get that.
Would you see value
details
in,
for planning?
Would you see value in a concept review for straight zoning sites or final plats after the preliminary plat's been approved?
What do you want to gain?
Well, that's I don't
earlier
necessarily know that there is
for who?
For the city to be able to be prepared for the infrastructure to serve that.
I think that this assisted living project that we talked about last week is a great example.
Yeah.
The one on Chapel Hill.
Straight rezone.
It was just straight zoning. I mean, could have come back with three houses. Instead, they came back with 100 and whatever units, and that's a huge difference.
Conceptual reviews, it's a potential developer is going to buy a piece of ground and they want to know all about it before they buy it. And so, you know, some of those we never come to fruition. So it's more of an information gathering from all the staff. Here's what you have at this site, and put the pieces together. Is there any issues?
Maybe rephrase the question. Have you had experiences where you don't have enough time to develop the infrastructure to serve that new building? Because the building is moving faster than the infrastructure can come to serve it.
Yeah. In the past, yes. Today, no, we pretty much say we don't have the infrastructure, and you're going to have to wait for us.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, that wasn't necessarily the case. We would look for some, try to build it as quick as we could.
Right. So do you think that the last few years downtown would have rolled out quite like they have if there had been concept reviews required?
Oh, we had concept reviews on the 27-story building, or 24-story, I can't remember which one it was, but they want to put it down at Bengals.
Didn't get built.
It blew up.
Right.
It was that. It never happened. And so, you know, that it was a whole bunch of things put together downtown that we were trying to piece it all together at the time. It just wasn't one property. It was a bunch of them coming in at once. Mm-hmm. Wanted to do a big story because we had no height restrictions.
Right.
So, you know, I didn't even know the university, but, you know, they were worried about being right next to the smokestack, being level with the smokestack. You know, there was no way to stop it. They wanted to do it. So I think, you know, we had the concept reviews that did bring it to fruition, and it did cause the issue that went public, because we had to take it to council and say, who gets the capacity? We don't want to make that decision.
So it sounds like it was useful in that case.
It was useful. It was very useful in that instance.
But with restrained infrastructure like we have today, now granted we may be catching up a little bit in certain areas, but we'll still have limitations in having that early required, not voluntary, required meeting early on to understand where the project's going. Now granted some of them may not go, but at least you start that dialogue early enough that you know what you're
going to do. I think you'd want to couch it kind of a change in use. You know, if this is going to be a change in use of the, of the property or parcel, you know, then you need to have a concept review because the density or whatever, if it's
Yeah.
Much greater than they
it's a shopping
more,
center replacing right. a shopping center is probably
That's
not a big deal.
Big deal.
But
so what about giving discretion to staff to make a decision about the value of a concept, of requiring a concept review on a straight zone?
Oh, I think Tim's pretty good at that. I think
he's pretty good at convincing people to do that.
Yeah. I think he's real good at that. I mean, and he's easy. He's approachable.
That's good.
After Tim, who knows? I mean, it all depends on the
right.
staff member
right.
who's comfortable with what.
If it's protocol, then
right.
you don't have to be approachable.
I do think it's something we could at least highly encourage a change of
sure.
use. In a straight zone,
or at least
a preliminary meeting, a high-level preliminary meeting should
yeah.
be
R3 to R1 wouldn't necessarily require.
Right.
But if you went up in, intensity, I'll just say in zoning, it probably would be a good thing.
And that would solve the trigger question we were talking about since we first started.
And just, I'm sorry, I want to make sure I understand this process question. So, if a concept review is required, then it gets scheduled and it happens, and then that's when the notice happens to neighbors and it's published in the paper.
Nobody knows more about that than I do. I haven't followed
yeah,
that.
It says they send out a postcard and it says the concept review for this property was had at the city building, and it's just a postcard and it just says if it's a proposed rezoning or if it's an annexation, it just says that, and it doesn't go into any details as far as what the plan actually was
right.
or anything. But yes, it is sent out, and it is sent out afterwards.
Right, and then if people are interested in that, they call planning, and planning tells them what.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, public knowledge. It's yeah. some.
I want to work as a notice before the concept review and public. Like public and concept review.
Well, that might be dangerous, but
yeah.
I mean, something that's just you're getting a feeler. It's just a perspective thing. It's nothing's guaranteed or anything. You give people, if it's controversial, I mean, and you're sending out, we're looking for facts, and then you have people coming that are voicing opinions about something that we haven't even fully formed our
idea. Open for public comment, open for public attendance.
I think it'd be premature.
I would too. That I don't even think we post what parcel they're asking about. It's just an area. It says in this area.
At that point,
we post the exact parcel, do we?
I think it has it hashed in like you do on the. It's been a while. I thought it had the property hatched that it was for, but.
Maybe. Yeah. I just thought we were identifying an area.
General area.
Where we had a concept review.
But they're at this point in time just scouting feasibility. It may not move forward. I think you don't want that to be in a public arena where they may just be exploratory.
Well, like I said, many of them don't come back. I mean, they readjust and come back.
It should be in public, I think.
I'm just trying to find where the right sort of insert point is. It's probably, everybody in here knows, but no way I'm going to address a controversial issue, is that a lot of times there's a public perception that a lot of decisions have been made before the public ever hears about what a development might be like. So are there recommendations that would, certainly we don't want to screw up anybody's speculative project, particularly for this property they don't own, right? I mean, that's really, really clear. But where is the point where it is appropriate, and we're creating public record to make sure that the public is aware of the public record being created?
Probably when we get plans to review. It's a 2-week cycle, isn't it?
But you have an opportunity and a reason.
We list the plans that come in a certain parcel every day.
And any of those.
Right, well, that's the.
And they're immediately reviewable once they're submitted as they're a public record at that point.
And any of those that I mentioned that were subject to concept review are also part of the public process. Is I think it's like 3 or 4 weeks after submission, after a time that your staff has had to review it. There's a public information meeting that the city puts on. They send out postcards to everybody in a certain radius, and invite them down to the city, and they talk about the submission in the city, and the planner who is in charge of that project goes over all the details of the project. And that's the first time I think the city actually holds a public kind of forum of what it is. Yeah. Even though when it first submitted, yes, it's on record and it's published, I don't know where, but if the citizens were savvy, they would be able to find when anything was submitted. But, and they would have had a postcard from the concept review, because annexations and rezonings require concept review, so they would have gotten that postcard too. But the first time they would actually see any details would be at the public information meeting, which would be after the formal submittal. Now, that being said, and this is by no means required, and it's subject to the type of developer and everything, but as the climate of just much more scrutiny with the public process and the stuff, I know we recommend strongly to all our clients that have one of those type of things to have a neighborhood meeting beforehand. Now, obviously, that's not required. That's not a public thing, but in city planning recommends that to anybody at the concept review. You need to make sure you talk to your neighbors and they're aware, you know, we're going to be asking them what their concerns are also, and obviously city council and planning and zoning are going to have public hearings where they're going to be coming up. So obviously that's not something that's required by ordinance or anything, but right. It is something that's becoming much and much more part of the process that you pretty much have to do.
Same thing.
So how long have we been doing that initial public meeting, the forum sort of meeting, roughly?
Since I started, which was 2007.
The problem, and this may not be, this is not probably the right venue, but that process, I think, needs to be tweaked, because the notice is only given, it's only given to neighbors that live 185 feet from the property, which I'm extremely close to another development that's going to be done, and I didn't get noticed. And
185-foot radius.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. That's,
and then the timing is so regimented that if you don't find out about it until,
if you don't have a neighborhood association, it does send it to the neighborhood association of anybody. But if you don't have a neighborhood
association. It's just outside the 185 feet. And then the timing with it being the public information meeting is tight, and then the PNC meeting is tight. So if you stumble into the process and it's already halfway through, but it's only been 10 days, you're left going, what the heck, this happened so fast.
That's where you get that public reaction, yeah. Like, this seems like it's a done deal, we weren't involved.
And it's because of the timing. I'm sorry, I'm talking over this section. It's too short.
I think it's too long.
Yeah. Both sides. Yeah.
But to bring it back to infrastructure, because that's what we're charged with, not the rest of the development, because that's more the planning and zoning's challenge, is when is the appropriate time for the city to be aware of a project to plan for infrastructure for that growth. And yeah, obviously if people are out fishing or scouting a project and it's very preliminary, you're going to couch it as may not happen, but you know, at one point in time, do you need more solidification of that process so you can start digging in what you need to do to serve that new facility?
The concept review is the appropriate place, and like I said, that's what happened downtown. We have never seen the amount of residential built. That was the first one out of they came to us with right after the deal was built over here on Walnut, and it was 24 or 27 floors. I can't remember the deal. You know, we weren't prepared for that.
I like the terminology you use, change of use, because I think that whether it's a new zoning or same zoning, if it's going to be a change of use of the property.
Yep.
Of any significance, I mean, then it needs to, that's when you need that planning review, pre-planning meeting.
Change of use is probably pretty good too, and that ties directly with like uniform or international building code as well. So that's when it triggers all of the updates for the, you know, a renovation or whatever. So from a professional side of things, that would be a logical trigger.
I agree. I would want something a little more solid than discretion of staff when it was required.
Yeah.
And so that when you, if you were required to do, let's say we implement this, you're required to do a change of use form, and didn't, and then you get to your, the building permit process, and they say, you have filled out your change of use form. And then you say, okay, and then you go back and do it. I mean, is there going to be a time frame or where the public could get information on this before they just whip out the, oh, I didn't fill it out, okay, there it is, now can I have my building permit?
I think the concept of you that would be triggered by the change of use, if you tried to make a formal submission and you hadn't gone through the steps that required concept review, they would kick back that application and say, we can't start reviewing this until you've had a concept review. Please schedule a concept review. You would schedule the concept review. It's usually a week to 2 weeks out, and they schedule the concept review. And then after you've had the concept review, you can then, after they give you back your notes, then you can make your formal submission.
But there are situations where you're not required to have a concept review.
Right now, yeah. And I think that is kind of what we're trying to get at. When should we require, if we don't like, if we feel like we're missing out on something we should be seeing earlier, in some cases like straight zoning applications for site plans or whatever, maybe we should be requiring concept reviews for those too, like in change of use situations, even though it's a straight zoning.
Yeah, I think that, like John commented, stay out of the residential, because if you know, I should have to do a change of use if I'm going to add a third bay in my garage.
We don't want.
If I'm going to take my house down and I'm going to build a, you know, a McDonald's, then that would be a change of use.
Well, what about you, before, I don't know what all the forms are, but before a building permit or land disturbance permits are issued, at least, pull a number out of the hat, 15 days prior to the issuance of that, change of use form had to have been submitted, so the city has time to, the departments have time to review it.
I can see where it can be expanded to include other things besides change of use. Like the historical preservation dilemma was in a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, we get a demolition permit one day and turn it on the next.
Yeah. Right.
Put in safeguards where that can't happen. And we're going to change the use. They should tear it down and replace it. I think the more and more you're informing the public of what's going on, the better you're going to be. What is going to be a change of use?
Would a change of use submission trigger the public?
Well, like that big lot down here on Broadway. Tank fields. You know, a lot of people are interested in what's going on and happen there. Mm-hmm. Regardless of whether they change the use. You know, be notified as soon as possible that something's in the works. It involves city staff. Mm-hmm. If I was living down there and then found out that they'd been having meetings with city staff for a year before they announced their plans, and nobody knew about it, I wouldn't feel too good about it.
Yeah. Is change of use too generic, or is that?
More intensity increase.
Sure,
definitely.
It's going to have to be defined. I think that we probably can't define it at this table. Mm-hmm. That we go recommending that something be defined, either the planning or the city work together to develop a definition of what that is and a mechanism to trigger that to happen
based
prior
on
to building permit submission, unless it's a straight permit that you're just going to tear down one convenience store, build a brand new convenience store. That's not going to be a change in use, but if you're building something different, it may trigger it.
Based on the theory that it gives the city a chance where, you know, target projects that the city would like to evaluate their infrastructure.
Yeah, I just want to be clear that we're only talking about infrastructure
right.
here. Recommendations
right.
are about infrastructure,
right.
not about people's general use of their property that
right.
they
right.
own.
Right.
It has to be, we're focusing on infrastructure, not development, so.
Right, and I agree.
I mean, you may not like what your neighbor does with their property.
Right.
Too bad if it works within confines of the.
There's other mechanisms Ben used to deal with. I don't want that in my backyard type. So,
right.
So that's not really our role other than
no.
making sure there's adequate
sure
infrastructure to serve whatever is going in.
Yeah.
We're relating this back to infrastructure, not just general development.
Right. So I do have a question about the 185 feet. Yeah, radius and infrastructure. You know, how far away can you get from a sewer problem and still be affected by it?
All the way to sewer problem, right?
It depends on what line you're talking about.
But that's the staff. But that's the staff's purview. I mean, if you have a homeowner a mile away that has a sewer problem that they think this, I mean, that seems like a little bit of a reach. And it is, it's not just...
Well, I'm trying to think of the intensity of a new development. Like, instead of adding three houses, you add 150 units, you know, and what kind of impact does that have on the sewer, and how far downstream is that going to affect people who should be informed that it's going
to
happen?
And it, I mean, so they send out individual letters and postcards to the 185 feet, which may, I'm not against increasing that because that is pretty narrow, but it also is in the newspaper and on the city's public floor. I mean, it's not like they're not notifying the rest of the community, it's just they're not directly notifying them.
It was only in the paper once on a Tuesday. I'm the same.
Yeah, well, so. I thought they had to like go through at least so many cycles and whatnot, but well, that's beside the point. But.
And that's not mandated, I don't think. Or no, the newspaper's mandated. Actually, the postcards were not required. And they do have 200 feet, just because.
I think there'll be some guidelines established.
My question is instead of change of use, should it be about density instead? Because really, for us, that's what that's...
Intensification of use.
Mm-hmm. It can be a change of use. You could, you could have more of an industrial format going in versus a commercial. So
you're not maybe getting more dense. You're just different enough to be...
Intensity then,
You know, you take something like a data center... You know, going in, high energy intensive data center is, you know, not going to cause problems within the community, but it's going to cause problems with infrastructure serving that. So it's, there's not too many people living there, very few bathrooms, but lots of electrical energy that needs to serve that data center.
But a data center won't be able to go in ARM, probably.
No, but it would be in a commercial, wouldn't it? Commercial. You know, where something of low energy intensity was, and they took that out and put in a high energy intensity facility. So it could be more than just density.
Just
it's
use
could be,
it would be
the change in use, whether it be population density or the type of energy consumption or utility consumption. It could be a high water user.
So our intention is really to figure out some trigger that has to do with... density
related to infrastructure.
Intensity or use could be.
Right. So does staff see any will you have additional staffing or resource needs if these kind of expansions and requirements were there? I mean, do you want to address that at some level?
I don't know that we'll need more staff. We might need a longer time frame. Let's say you're going to take a green space, much like when the hospital did, and build a hospital. It takes us a long time to review a hospital than it would a apartment complex. So, you know, review time may be stretched out a little bit, depending on the change. What do you think, Dan?
Yeah. I can't really see any other.
I mean, we do it today, so requiring it is not a big thing.
Okay.
I think we would change the use in the broadest terms is, you know, kind of how I would look at it. I think Greg is right. Well, it could be an electrical problem. It could be a water problem. We don't know. It's not use in density per se, but it's a change in what's there, basically, in the broadest sense.
Do you, any of you folks in the industry know, is there any, what is the ratio of projects that come through that are working on straight zoning and those that require that have some sort of requirement that trigger review.
I would say there is a lot more straight zone property in the city than there is planned zoning. Now that's changing, but.
So 75-25, 10-1, I'm just trying to get a sense of the scale of projects that go through that aren't reviewed in terms of, well, I mean, I know they're all eventually reviewed, but.
I guess if you include, and I only can go off what I've our business, and I guess if you include residential subdivisions, which are considered straight zoning, even though they kind of have, at the preliminary plat stage, they have some other, but I don't know, probably 4 out of 5 are straight zoning. I don't know.
Okay.
3 out of 4, maybe. I think you're right.
I think even higher than that.
Yeah, so you're, from your point of view, you're probably a lot more straight zoning than
I'd
we
say
are.
9 to 10.
Because you're doing
9 out of 10.
Renovations.
Yeah, a lot of renovations. Yeah, a lot of. And all of those require building permits.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, when you're looking at the
so
total
you,
amount
yeah,
of building
yeah,
permits.
So I might be low.
Okay, just curious.
Because I think with the new
zoning. Yeah.
They're doing away with a lot of the land stuff.
Yes.
I mean, they're trying to go to straight zoning, so we don't have all these different plans.
But what triggered one of the reasons we're talking here today in this whole group was the fact that we had a lot of street zoning redevelopment that caused strain on our infrastructure.
Yes,
right.
And so that's what we're, I think that change of use is, that needs to happen early enough before permit request.
I just pulled up the International Building Code just to review, just to look at all of the use groups. And for instance, residential does have 4 use groups within classifications. And per building permit, if we're changing from an R1 to an R2 or an R2 to an R3, R3 to an R4, that does trigger a change in use. And what that does do for renovation projects is that it triggers bringing that building up to code in a lot of ways that it wouldn't have to be brought up to code if it was staying R2 to R2.
Mm-hmm.
The caveat, so assemblies are the same way. There are 5 different assembly groups. So if you had an assembly property, and again, you're going to make it a larger assembly, which would involve parking, roads, storm, sanitary, the whole thing, that would trigger it as well. The one that only has, that has no other uses is B. B's just straight B. But all the other ones have many layers. Institutional has 1, 2, 3, and 4, so that's like hospitals. So I think there might be something to that change in use, just because, again, that example on Chapel Hill is a pretty good example of how it was straight zoned and they...
It just is a minor point. It could very easily could have not required a concept review, but there was a road vacation in a minor plat that required the concept review.
So it did.
Mm-hmm. All right. Other thoughts about Tim's presentation?
So what we came out of this is maybe some recommendation on the concept review, a recommendation on the scorecard. It seems like we've had some conversation. I don't know if we refined what exactly we're going to say. Somebody, I guess, might want to take a stab at that.
I will, if that's okay.
Sure. There was one thing I didn't ask specifically, even though it was kind of insinuated. I was wondering how the new development code, and I don't know if John will be able to answer this or not, but how it addressed, how the new unified development code addresses exactly financial contributions for impacts to infrastructure. I don't think it necessarily addresses it specifically, other than traffic studies required with some criteria, but
I think you're correct.
I don't know if that's something that...
So, I'm sorry, say that again.
Well, I was just curious on how exactly the new Unified Development Code addressed impacts to existing infrastructure from new development, and whether there was, if it specified exactly what financial contributions or what percent contributions would be required for those impacts from new development. I know it does require, and there is some criteria in there for traffic studies required, and there is some criteria under there, and I haven't read it enough to know, but I know we have some recommendations that we've already stated about traffic study type stuff that would go towards that. I don't necessarily have any specific recommendation in mind. I was kind of just curious on, I wish I would have thought to ask him while he was here, but what exactly those requirements are in the new Unified Development Code.
Did you want to contribute?
I don't know for sure, Cody. I don't think it addresses it because the costs are going to change over time. I don't know exactly. They've been doing it just, 2-3 years now, so yeah. I don't know if it's kept up. So.
Okay. If you wanted to send him your question in email, I bet he would respond to us and we could review it as an agenda item.
Okay.
Other thoughts on Tim's presentation? All right. Do we want to move to 2 and talk about the electric utility issues and recommendations? And I don't know if folks had a chance to look at John's first draft of the sort of introduction and have any comments on that, or if we want to table this part of it until he's back. And
I'd recommend we table it. John's going to have to write that if he needs to hear that feedback correctly.
Right. Okay.
And I think part of, I'm not going to get into it specifically, but I think it's part of the conversation when he comes, and we can talk about this when we talk about bills too, is how we incorporate this into the format of your outline that you had provided. Mm-hmm. Because this is, to me, I mean, I like a lot of stuff he says, but it's more of the previous type of outline we had, where we have the narrative and then you have the recommendations, which is a little bit different than what we were planning on, mm-hmm. or you have outlined in your report style.
Okay, and then Bill also sent an update to his recommendations this week. And I wanted to give you a chance, Bill, to highlight updates that you've made. And then the other piece, I think, is that I, at least in my mind, sort of flows out of this is I would like to sort of star or put a check mark by ones that we want to make sure are framed for next week's conversation, because they do seem to be largely related to billing issues, charging issues.
Well, I kind of took Mr. Dysock's recommendation last week to concentrate on the billing rather than the master meters. Mm-hmm. So these have all got to do with billing. The first one is that the, I think it ought to apply to fire and water also. But since we're not reviewing fire and water, fire flow, I put that note up at the top. But the minimum monthly food service charge ought to be billed to the owner of each apartment and business unit where the electric and sewer service is provided, regardless of how the property is metered. I'm not saying that the present minimum charge will be applied, which ought to be a minimum charge applied. I think the present minimum charge is too high. And possibly, and then second one, I guess. Where I started talking about building the property that's unoccupied, perhaps there ought to be a discounted minimum charge that's lower than building the property that's occupied, which I don't think it'd be up to the city to evaluate that and determine what the appropriate base charge would be.
How would we bill if there's not a meter? I mean, is this a utility charge? If there's not a meter, like, I guess there's a meter, but the meter may be tied to the tenant, not the owner.
Oh, if it's meter, it'd be tied to the tenant. If it's individual meter, it'd be tied to the tenant.
Right.
When you get a building permit, they know how many apartments in the building. Mm-hmm. They can survey the rest of it.
If you had a master meter, it would be tied to the owner.
Yes.
Well, he is.
And you may have a master electric meter, right, and water meter. You may have only a master water meter. But there are master electric meters in town for apartment complexes.
So is the suggestion, if it's a master meter, that the owner pays and then they include the reimbursement of that in, like, the rent?
I think
in other words, you're just going to look. You're going to
cost per dwelling. So
you're going to hold the owner accountable
for the
master meter, and then what? However, they get reimbursed for that.
Well, they already are held accountable right now.
Right.
So they're paying a low fee compared to
individual
meter.
But what you're saying is, if there's 10 units, then all of a sudden there's a charge for all 10 units, even if there's just one meter. Right?
Yes.
So then the owners.
And this ought to be implemented. That would be given a year's notice before implementing this, so they have time to change their leases or adjust whatever cash flow they need to adjust. Sewer did the same thing in 2008. They give everybody 30 days' notice they're going to do it.
30 days.
Which wasn't very good. And they rescinded it in 2011.
I kind of like the idea. I think I like the idea. I think we it definitely should be evaluated technically with data and with the cost of service study or whatever. But I definitely like the idea of, I don't see a problem with the idea of, you know, having the base fee for the number of units, as opposed to getting a discount just because you had a master meter. You don't have to pay the sum of the individual units. And I do like the idea of having a base charge, even if your meter is inactive, because of Bill's justifications here, that you still have the infrastructure to the property, you still get the benefit of being able to turn on the infrastructure whenever you want and reserve the capacity, or you have the capacity because you previously had that meter. I do think, and that's another thing that could be mentioned, is being evaluated with the future cost of service study, what that base charge should be when the meter is off. Like Bill said, it might not need to be as high, probably shouldn't be as high. It probably should be a very base minimum charge. With a slight rewording, or maybe not even rewording, but just some additional wording, I seem to like where those two are going. Those first two, I think. Or was it first three? As far as the part I get a little confused about, and I don't see, I'm having trouble wrapping my head around, is requiring it to be the owner's responsibility versus the tenant's responsibility. If the tenant has the account, the tenant should pay. If they aren't paying, then it should revert to the owner. I mean, in theory, the owner should be responsible.
There's no meter to the tenant.
It's not. What?
They need the tenant's not paying a utility bill. It's in their rent.
Well, no,
so there's no way.
Not just master meters. I'm just saying, like, in general.
In general.
Because he's kind of flipping back between master and just in general. Of who should be, you know, at first he says it should be responsible to the owner, but, you know, the city should be able to allow it to be billed to the account holder, but it should revert back to the owner if they default or whatever, which seems like a reasonable thing to want to do, but...
Well, how is that reasonable?
if the owner has a tenant who defaults on their payment, and yeah. then it should revert back to the owner.
And then the charges should revert back to the owner?
Yeah, the owner's getting the rent. The owner's making a profit on the property. The owner well, suffers a loss on the property.
But the owner doesn't have any control over how much utility usage a tenant...
Well, the owner's got the control over the tenant. Some owners have a higher delinquency rate for their properties than others. A very much higher delinquency rate because they don't screen their tenants. Some owners have very, very low utility delinquency rate for tenants. And I'll pay for that. What they pay for is pay for delinquent bills. There's state law that says you can just bill them so much, I don't know the formula, but so many months.
Right, but a property owner doesn't really have any legitimate reason to be in somebody's, in a renter's space when they do things like have a constantly flowing toilet for 3 or 4 months and rack up thousands of dollars in water bills, but haven't made a complaint and haven't let anybody know. I mean, part of renting to somebody is giving them control of the space of that place. You can't.
I think if it's sub-metered, I agree. I don't think that the owner should have to, or the property should have to pick up the bill that the tenant doesn't pay the
yeah,
bill.
Yeah, and I guess a way around that is if there's, if could there be some trigger in unexpected, unusual usage so that the city lets a property owner know that their meter on one of their properties
you
is...
separate the minimum charge from the usage charge. Mm-hmm. Make the property owner responsible for the tenant's delinquent base charge.
Sure, that makes sense.
And not the tenant's usage charge.
Right.
Yeah. If the usage part is going unpaid, that's between the account holder and the city. Well, we've talked before about the city requiring deposits where they're not.
But it's very low for the amount of the bill. It's like $150 or $200 for all utility deposits together.
Right. So if you're trying to solve a problem because of a subset of bad actors, maybe the solution is to find a way to hold bad actors accountable and not everybody.
Work on that.
Right, like if there's really a subset that has a regular and intensive problem with tenants not paying their bills, there should be some way to identify that in a criteria set so then
the owner can step in and say something.
It won't take very long in this small town for people to figure out that they can walk away from their bills.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, they can't walk away from it any more than they always did.
Well,
the city can still go after the tenant.
There's nothing to go after. Yeah. I could see it happening more.
I mean, in some ways, this is a responsibility shift off of the city for you know, a enterprise, providing an enterprise service and onto the property owner, which, I mean, that's...
I understand your point, but like if I get delinquent on my utility bill at home, I can't, the city's going to shut it off, but I can't put my wife's name. They're not going to do that. It's going to set up until the bill gets paid. Or if you get a landlord...
Yeah, but your wife is also going to know if you start running a data center out of your basement too.
I can go along with your suggestion of not holding responsible for the usage charge.
Yeah. Okay. Good. That makes sense.
I agree. Go back on your sub-metering topic, Bill. I think, reading through that that document you sent. I'd read similar information on submetering and with smart metering technology coming out to where it may reach a point where it's very cost effective to install submetering in multiple dwellings. You know, right now, that's why they want to go to that master meter, because it's all the cost of the copper and the meters, and we've got to go read the meters. And as the technology is developing, they're going to you know, wireless communication, so those devices are easy to install right in the line coming in and communicate back to a central meter to process the data back to the utility. I think that we probably should put a statement in there that the city should continue to explore the technology and come to a point where they may want to recommend smart metering technology in their metering portfolio. I don't know where you are, Ted, right now on electric meters as far as smart metering technology. Are you employing any AMI meters out there?
We have AMRs.
AMRs.
AMRs don't have AMIs yet. We've done some studies on it, and we're looking to do a pilot on it in the not too distant future. But it's going to really utilize AMR collections probably. But, you know, we do have AMIs on the horizon, but we're going to pilot it first.
What are AMRs?
Automated reads. So all we can do is just read the data. We don't get to do remote disconnects and things like that.
The AMIs, you get a lot more information, and you can do demand side billing. So basically, you've got real time information, and so instead of just a flat rate for your electricity 24/7, you may pay based on the price of the market. So if the price is real high in the afternoon and you're running your dryer, you're going to pay very high prices for that electricity.
Yeah, AMIs are a lot smarter device. They just have a lot more capability to control and read, right, and basically the interval the data is stored and reported to the utility.
Right. And then this would go back out to the consumer, and people could make informed decisions on when to use their stock.
That's great. Right. Yeah.
But there's a really big communication between the customer and the utility that you have to establish.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
We ain't got there yet.
My husband will be thrilled to get to figure all that out.
Watching it all.
Some people don't want to.
Turn off the lights. Turn off the lights, the price just went up.
Right.
Yeah, you won't have your TV on at 7 or 8.
All right, okay. Other comments on Bill's recommendations?
The next one's from the top of page 2. The basic concept of most cost of service studies is that each customer class pays for its own usage. Mm-hmm. Residential pays for residential, and commercial pays for commercial. In fact, there's a surcharge that says that. That's where I got this wording from. But to do this, you're going to have to separate out master meters. You're going to have to count as residential rather than commercial. Paper and tires, you've got a master electric meter. It's probably a large general service meter.
I'm assuming that, it's a demand meter there.
But it's the usage is kind of on the large general service category, classification. It ought to be kind of residential. You not change the billing or the charge, you just count that meter's usage as residential usage.
What is it counted as now?
Large general service.
It operates what's called a demand rate. There's a demand charge and an energy charge.
It's
just an energy charge.
How it's accounted for.
Usually demand meter is a more accurate way to recover the cost.
I'm saying you wouldn't change the meter. You just change how it's accounted for. Like on the sewer is being counted as non-residential. Look at the master water meter. But to count that billing as residential billing, residential served cost, revenue.
I know ideally we'd like to have more demand meter in our system, not necessarily less.
I'm not talking about changing the meter.
I know, it's just the way you bill it. We'd like more bill on demand basis. Demand billing is
forward. I'm at home with that.
But you, you
residential doesn't.
You don't have a demand meter on a large residential facility.
None of our residential rates are demand.
Even in like an R3, like a multi, like an apartment complex with a single meter.
Yeah, there's very few of those. But like you said, in the Pacman Tower case, that would be an
example.
You would be a demand meter basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Large general services.
Pacman would be large general services.
And the other benefit of a demand meter, in addition, as Ted indicated, provided a better calculation of the real usages. It also incentivizes the people paying the demand to reduce their peak demand, which delays the need for new capacity, which we all benefit from as a consumer, by not having to build new power plants or new infrastructure to serve that demand.
Yeah, demand is truly the gauge of the impact on the system. So we charge for impact on the system through demand. If you bill on energy only, you really don't know when it happens or how it's timed out. It's really not a very
What I was trying to say is that if residential is using 60% of electricity, residential would be paying 60% of the cost. The same as how much it costs to make electricity. And if residential is using 60% of the electricity, they ought to be paying 60% of the cost. And to do that, you can't count large power buildings with a mass meter as non-residential. You got to count residential.
Are we mixing it though? Because in the cost of service study, aren't they looking at that large meter at Pacman as a non-resident, as a demand meter? Like, they're not including it in that 60%, are they?
They're looking at it as a non-residential meter.
Yeah. So, and they have rates based on the impact from non-residential on the system.
They take that usage out of the large general service category and put it in the residential category. Electricity that building uses is residential.
It may be residential, but they're still analyzing it and coming up with the rates, aren't they, based on it, it's actually functioning, you know?
Imagine they adjust the rates, too.
I'm not real clear on.
Is Pacman the only one in the defined downtown region that we're talking about here?
Okay.
Is there others? Oak Towers, there's just a handful, but in the news, new...
Just a handful.
The new apartment complexes that are going in, they're individual electric meters, is that correct or incorrect? They're all individual electric meters. I don't know what they are in water, but they're individual electric.
They are individual.
Right, and they're on residential rate.
Yes. I mean, obviously there's some commercial sections on some of
them. That might have a commercial meter,
yeah.
But you've got about 22,000 apartments approximately in town. About half of them are master meter for water.
For water?
For water. Although we're not evaluating water.
Right, I was just pulling back to our scope, and our scope on the electric is the downtown area. And so what is the challenge that we have? And so it's just a few high-rise facilities, but...
Three big ones, Oak Towers, Pacman Towers, apartment complex, Tiger Village, Tiger Place.
Yeah, I'd have to have Jim talk about it. He'd have a better sense of how many different ones there are on our system. I don't think there's very many master meters downtown.
Well, I mean, there's not that many master meters on our entire system. I mean, it's...
All right.
And you're not doing it now and into the future.
Correct.
Wait, how about Tiger Place retirement home?
Maybe it's like there needs to be a little more defined definition, because you've got a hotel. A hotel in all essence is a residential property, temporary residence, and it's got a single meter. Then you've got you got a retirement facility.
Unless you stay there for more than 30 days,
I think. Is that what the definition now, 30 days?
It's in the ordinance.
Yeah, okay. So it does tap that should be individual meter if it's
dwelling unit.
More than 30 days resident.
So the city wouldn't allow a master electric meter right now if somebody was to
have a
residential facility. Like, if another Oak Towers or Pacman Towers, would you allow it to be master meter?
No, I mean what we've done on like Opus and the Rise is we require them to have There is a, in a planned zoning district, if they have a unique metering situation, like a net metering type situation, where they want to do, you know, they want to have a community type solar arrangement, or if they're doing some kind of, I think we have
a backup generator.
Backup generator, or like a distributed heating system, like a geothermal, or you know, it was common to the whole place that, you know, the, you know, it made more, you know, that there's a specific exception in the ordinance that would allow us to master meter that in that situation, but only in that type of situation.
But that would be a condominium own process, so that everyone shares out. Yeah.
It would be part of the planned zoning district, right. So that would all go in front of council for approval.
Well, I guess I want to make sure we're not attempting to address a problem that is in the process of aging out anyway.
I think in some of the installations that were in there, you know, it was services that were requested to be a three-phase, and we don't have residential three-phase meters or, you know, and so it was, you know, up until recently, when microprocessor-based meters came available, three-phase meters were extremely expensive, and you wouldn't want to have, you wouldn't want to distribute it, you know, if you had a 100-unit tower, you wouldn't want to have had 100 three-phase meters to invest in a residential unit that was good. You'd never get the payback on that meter individually, and so, I mean, I think in the few instances where there are residential master meters, it's one, they're taking three-phase service, and two, it would have been cost prohibitive at the time, because when they were requested, it was before metering was really, you know, nowadays there's not much difference between a three-phase meter and a single-phase meter.
On the rise, I originally thought about requesting a master meter.
They had, and then when, you know, we did instruct them that, you know, you're going to have to request a zoning change to do that, and they didn't want to do that. Initially, they were going to put meters on the exterior of their building, and they found that cost prohibitive as well, and so they're doing like a metering closet on each, or every other floor, I believe.
Third floor or so.
Something like that.
Well, yeah, and you're putting in, and Chad was talking about AMR meters in there, so you get automated reading.
All of our meters, all of our electric meters.
Have all AMR now.
They'll be distributed in the building, yes.
Okay.
The city ought to encourage metering in as many places as possible, in my opinion.
I think that's a good introductory sort of statement or sentence. Just set a general tone for it. All right.
And the last one is just to emphasize that I feel the electric connection fee is should be established. I think John Conway indicated that that's been proposed by mm-hmm. somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Any update on that?
Well, we've worked on one. We have a draft proposed that the Water and Light Advisory Board is currently looking at, plus the city legal and city management folks are in fact, I think that's going to be a discussion at the next advisory board meeting.
You remember off the top, you remember off the top of your head, like what some of the justifications and the scale of those connection fees would be?
No, but I do know that it was pretty fairly project specific. In other words, once you brought something forward, you had to do an analysis of how much it, you know, what was the cost impact of the utility. And then the concept was that there was a certain amount of investment. If your project exceeded that investment, then there was a methodology to have you basically participate in the capital cost to connect you to the system.
To essentially try to keep the utility whole.
Yeah, so you didn't adversely impact the rest of the customer base with this one customer.
So if you've got a small entity coming in, you know, they're not going to recoup enough. You're not going to recoup enough rate over time to offset the expense of putting in the connection.
Right. So a very simple example is like in co-ops, oftentimes they have a big service territory, so somebody comes and says, I need a 5-mile line out there, and they'll say, well, because of how much you're going to use, and you tell us how much you're going to use, because of how much you're going to use, we're only going to extend the line 1 mile. Anything past a 1 mile, you get to pay for it. Because that's how much they're going to be willing to invest in utility and you as a customer based upon your projected consumption. And that's a typical co-op practice. This was kind of like that, but it's structured differently, more from a financial analysis perspective, rather than participation in line construction.
Is this a fundamental, I think, what we've kind of talked about, different way of collecting funding for this, since now there is no connection fee, it's all on the rate, and what you get back from the rate, or?
Well, there is some participation currently by the developers. So when we have a developer going in, that they do some of the work to build the system.
So would that be still required, or would there be some offset for that?
I think the intention is that it would all be calculated as a utility cost.
It would all be part of the equation.
Now, right now, then, pulling back into the downtown community area, who pays for a switch or a transformer? The utility or the project?
No, the utility.
Not the project.
Right.
So if you
mostly, and even this methodology that we're talking about, if you have fairly dense or even housing that infrastructure already exists, it's unlikely to pay to expand infrastructure.
Right, but so, you would have to put transformation in and a switch probably.
Right, but typically those costs would fall within those utilities. Depending on the size, and you know, I mean, obviously, if they only use 100 megawatts for 1 hour a month, then you know, there's not much revenue for a big demand. So those things get taken into account.
Okay, 100 megawatts for 1 hour of 1 month.
There's research equipment.
Research reactor.
So I got lost just a little bit in the technical part of that. I understood you initially to say, Tad, that is it water and light that is thinking about a connection fee?
Yes, that draft has been put together. Okay. It's been presented to the Water and Light Advisory Board a couple of times, and the legal department's looking at it too. Mm-hmm. I think the legal department's actually coming to the next Water and Light Advisory Board to talk about some of the ramifications and how it's considered.
Okay.
And some of the
and then how does that relate to the statement you were just making a minute ago and describing? This is how lost I am.
Well, I was actually trying to describe the general concepts behind what the methodology is behind the connection policy.
Okay, but that methodology is what determines what a connection fee is. So it would be the fee would be determined by the development as opposed to having a standard fee.
Yes, correct. It is. It's basically determined by how much cost to provide service and what type of service and how much consumption they need. So it's a cost of. It's basically a project by project basis. This would be calculated.
So I'd hate to make a recommendation without reading that, and I probably wouldn't, but it seems like this is exactly what we were trying to, or what you were trying to recommend with this connection fee, by recommending that the city incorporate the electric connection fee.
Do what now?
This policy that they're trying to, that legal and the Water and Light Advisory Board are looking at, seems like exactly what we are trying to recommend the city council
I didn't adopt. I didn't read the policy, but
I've seen it. Yeah, but just from what he said about what it is and the connection fee, I mean, it seems like that would be completely reasonable.
I think so.
So you would, what you're thinking, would charge one of these downtown developments a connection fee, even though they're right on the infrastructure, similar to you charge one that you have to extend to, or is they pay different fees?
We would use the same methodology, but the cost, I'm assuming, would be drastically different depending on how much infrastructure you have to expand and how much they're going to consume. That's
right.
The problem.
So if you're a large electric consumer, you're incentivized to
put your facility next to the capacity of the electrical system.
Exactly.
Similar to the co-op option.
Right, but use would still be, anticipated use would still be considered too, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
So,
yeah.
So just locating to increase density wouldn't give a builder or a developer a break that others wouldn't be getting because use would be taken into consideration.
Sure. But like I said, given the same usage, if you locate in a different place on the system, there'll be different cost impacts to extend the system to.
It just seems like we've got got a water connection fee and a sewer connection fee. Mm-hmm. And an electric connection fee is not that much different.
Well, and there's there's unintended consequences too. I mean, we might want people to build near existing utility resources, but we also might not want to destroy everything historic that we have. I mean, there's more than there's more than one thing we value.
Electric connection fee would do that.
Generally, I don't think a connection fee would do that. I think that it's worth thinking through the intended and unintended consequences of any methodology to see what other behaviors it might trigger or incentives it might give.
That's why I'd like to read it, too.
Yeah, right.
But in concept, I like how it's based on...
What is the advisory board meeting?
Oh, we from today at 5:00.
8:00 in the morning, where at?
4:00 or something.
Next Tuesday.
Wednesday, 31st.
So after we meet, we'll be the 30th, are we?
Is this policy something that your staff has prepared and presented? Or did
we
you
presented it. It was actually developed by our consultant that does a cost of service study. So we have a consultant look into it and develop it.
And you guys had some input, you guys are supportive of it, you guys, obviously you submitted to them, or?
We I caution the user to support it because we were asked to do this and we came up with something that was the most equitable approach that we thought could work to meet this request. I'm not sure we would say the should or
you don't
should.
Know if you have an opinion on.
I don't like to say I don't.
Okay. You don't have. Okay, other comments on these electric utility issues and recommendations?
Well, one thing, I guess, I'm not off this connection fee, but one thing I was thinking about with this connection fee, I would be hesitant to just, it's kind of on the other side of the coin from what I was just saying where it seemed reasonable, but I also think, I don't know, I haven't heard anything yet from the presentations that we're woefully underfunded or we haven't had the money in the electric utility. And we had 68% approval on the most recent bond. It seems like the electric utility is getting their money and it's not, the money doesn't, and I may be way off, but I just haven't heard it that we are in a very bad spot or in a bad spot that we're looking to increase funding. So I'd be hesitant to just throw out some big connection fee that's just like,
I don't think the connection would increase funding, lower my utility bills.
Yeah. Well, that should be part of the recommendation.
Part of the big, part of the entire package. I'd pay less.
Well, I mean, sure, a lot of it is just where does the funding come from? There's a lot of tools in the utility to make sure you break the road and take to continue to provide the service. It would just be,
so you're saying how you get it as opposed to
who pays.
So there should be a corresponding recommendation with the increasing electric connection fee that the corresponding decrease in rate fee.
Well, they need to evaluate.
Okay.
But one thing you gotta realize, anytime you put a fee that's kind of tied to development, it's gonna go like this, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't, it's going to be really hard to every year put this money in your budget because you don't know what it's going to do.
But you do get it.
You do get it some year. Well, we get it some years up here, some years down here, depending on how the development
goes. The connection fee might bring in $1 million a year. Well, you don't take $1 million and buy something with it. You take $1 million and...
Well, typically, if you were bringing in connection charges, you would incur connection expenses too.
Wouldn't be the offset though. Hope your fee be more than your expenses.
We have a breakdown of
city works on a cost recovery basis, right?
Yeah.
The recovery cost. And if you go look at the budget, he's not up to his 20% coverage rate either. So,
I mean, we are asking for a 2% rate increase because our debt is earlier than that coverage ratio.
How many million dollars is that?
Is our what?
2%.
A year? That'd be about $1.2 million a year.
Are the electric revenue streams and expenses, is that online? We didn't. Is that on our website?
Budget's online.
The cost of service, the most recent cost of service study, did they get electric cost of service study?
Is this it? Is it the 2012 one? Is that the most recent?
Is that on the Google site?
I'll check with Carol in the morning. John sent me this hard copy.
If it's not,
okay.
Is this rate increase going to council soon? And what's
it's been through introduction of
one council meeting. Okay.
Work session. So we've got the two meetings in September that we'll be concerning with all
and this is different than the 2-3% increases that were voted on for
We don't have any debt coverage
transmission project
this year. This is just an
O&M change. Okay.
Related, has there been any more movement on the substation and rerouting issue? No,
we're, a couple months ago we worked with the council and they gave us some options they'd like to have investigated, and that's what we're doing now. We're investigating. It takes a while to do that. We have to work with all our neighboring utilities, work through the models, physical access. It's not a short process.
The Tribune had a chat form last night.
Oh, yeah. Did you participate?
I didn't participate. I read it.
How was it?
It's interesting. I read it. John Conway come in half a dozen times.
One of these.
One of the
big speaking of John, this is off record, not part of this, but John.
I couldn't hear it either.
John wrote a letter to the editor, to the Tribune, a tribute to Sherman Brown.
Oh, yes, I saw it.
That was a really, really nice article.
Yeah, really nice.
A couple days ago.
Today, it came out yesterday's paper.
Yeah.
I saw it online, but yes. Real nice.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Any other thoughts for this evening on electricity utility issues? All right. That's comments on the interim report.
What exactly changes?
Exactly the ones that were on my update sheet from when we talked about it last. So I added the staff list, focusing on people who are providing direct support to the project, to the task force, or who have spoken. Filled out the presenter's piece. We talked through some wording changes on the report outline that I added. Cody, I think the one thing that we left sort of up in the air a little bit was global recommendations, as G And I have a note that says might move up to the beginning of this section. I didn't put that in my notes on this because I don't think it's terribly material to the general outline of the report.
Not there may be global recommendations that are pretty mundane that shouldn't be up at the top.
Right.
I think that if it warrants to be up at the top,
well, that's what the number one, or number, yeah, number one would be for, I guess.
Yeah.
Right.
So that brings us to actually incorporating what material we have into this format.
Right.
Since this is quite a bit different than what our format is now. Which I kind of foresee, like, when we talked about, I volunteered to do the streets, and I think Greg thought about to do the storm sewer.
Right.
Storm sewers. Maybe take a stab at separating this out and putting different sections of that narrative and recommendations into each of these spots, and then they would be combined together with the other structure parts, and then you would have to meld them together, I guess, but...
Is there any way we can use our notes and have staff compile it?
I think that's a big ask.
At a point where it's clear enough for that to happen.
Right, right.
But I think as far as if I just look at, from my point of view, of the streets aspects, if I like take the executive summary 1A, and I break out the recommendations. Well, some of this I actually wouldn't need a different narrative for each one.
Right.
But like 1C, like break out the highest priority recommendations. Obviously, there would be discussion after I picked them. But then you would incorporate those with Greg's that he thought were the top five with storm sewer and Bill's that he thought were top five. And then the summary for 2A, the summary of previous reports, recommendations, and literature reviewed, I would have a paragraph about the streets related to that. And then everybody else would have their own, and they would incorporate it into that section. Or, you know, once we each picked our narrative or had a narrative, we could combine them all.
And doing it this way is going to create a lot more work on us because you're integrating everything into one report versus, I think what we were looking at before was a chapter for each of the categories and then a one overall executive summary. Integrating it all together is going to, I've done it before, projects like this, it's a lot of work. But it just may take longer to get it done that way. That doesn't mean you could still do it. You could have actually each report stand on its own, but you pull information from the report into the executive summary. It'd just be duplicated in the main body of the report, like top recommendations. You pull in the executive summary.
So I was, and maybe it's partly just a different use of language that people use to describe this. And I know that different professions address report writing in different ways, but typically in what I do, we write the executive summary last, right, after you write everything else. And when I developed this outline, what I did was look at the existing drafts. And I see the existing drafts being sort of split up into pieces that fit into these various categories, and then adding some process pieces like summary of previous reports and recommendations. To me, that's as simple as, you know, we requested the following reports done by the city in these years and reviewed them, and reference back to the city's Google site to send people for more detail on what we took a look at. Talk a little bit about the kinds of presentations that we had, who gave them, what they covered. In some ways, that would be kind of boilerplate because these guys have been very consistent in a helpful way at talking about the history of the utility, talking about sort of current status, talking about things they want to do. So just to give a to create a record of what informed our recommendations, what kind of information we had to inform our recommendations. And then under Section 3, recommendations, you know, the first sections of the existing drafts go over some of the history, some of the existing recommendations. And then they...
But you would include those narratives with the
Yeah, I think so, like at the beginning. So okay. Recommend A and B of this outline is essentially a description of or a rationalization of how we developed these categories. And then I think it's important to make a statement about, you know, people had different ideas, and here's how we sort of prioritized what we talked about. Here's how we approach the idea of support and dissent versus degree of consensus. And then it breaks down into the utilities themselves, and that's where the existing narratives plug in.
Yeah, I just thought you wanted recommendations under those. Didn't have it. I mean, where would the narrative piece go?
Yeah, no, I think that narrative piece is important to go with it, right. And then public input, too, is just sort of a summarization piece. Here's the people that showed up. Here's what they had to say and offer. Here's their statements. And that really could possibly go into the appendix, you know, as D in the appendix. But, you know, people take the time to submit narratives and spend time with us. It seems like it's worthy of a section of the report. But it doesn't have to be. And then the executive summary gets pulled out of the recommendations in Section 3. And
parts of the narrative.
Yeah, parts of it. You know, like punchy bullet points, mm-hmm. taking paragraphs down to a summarizing sentence and then encouraging people to look deeper if they're interested in it. Because there are always going to be those people that will only read those first two mm-hmm. pages. And...
So you talk about the... Like,
and they won't read any of the rest of it if you don't give them those two pages.
So, like, for example, we would talk about, like, with storms there are... that it's severely underfunded, and that could be, like, the... You don't have to read the rest of the thing to understand that. Or, like, streets,
right.
how we're concerned about the taxes going down.
Right, and so, and A and B on the executive summary would be very short narratives that essentially summarize Section 2 and the beginning of Section 3, right? Just even in the executive summary, you want to give enough process information that your recommendations are credible and clearly informed by mm-hmm. process.
So you're seeing, like, Sections 1 and 2, the executive summary and the description, those two pieces of it being relatively short, right?
Right.
So,
right.
like, maybe a page or two, and then the recommendations part is the really lengthy meat of the whole thing.
Right. So, in my mind, I think that we're farther along than maybe this looked when you guys first read it. I don't want to, in any way, get rid of anybody's work that they've done. I really appreciate it.
I didn't say this. That the concern I had, and I like this outline in general, and I think it would be the concern, I guess, one of the things is incorporating is, well, I have trouble articulating this, but if this was just streets and you had an executive summary and you had recommendations and then you had a description of the work process and then you had the recommendations and then you have public input in the appendix, that would be relatively straightforward mm-hmm. to follow. Even though you talk about the process briefly in the executive summary, in length in the description, and then also again in the recommendations, it's a little redundant, but you want to be able to pull out any section. And I'm like, okay, that makes sense. I understand you're not trying to take away anything we have.
Right.
It's just reorganizing the account. But furthering my concern, I guess, would be that you have, in this executive summary, you have all the different infrastructure, and then in the processes you have
all the different infrastructure, and then in the recommendations you have all the different infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's going to get a little...
Actually, I don't intend to address all of the different utilities in Section 2. I mean, that really is a section describing the workflow and the work process.
Okay.
So yeah. You wouldn't talk about what... Really, when it says summary of staff reports, you're saying, like, you know, Aaron Keyes spoke about storm sewer and Ryan spoke about electrical. You're not going to, like,
right.
thinking we're going to, like, talk about what they talked about there. You're
no,
just saying
it would be very much like that.
Yeah.
Right. It's really a list
almost
of resources more than anything.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's a listing of resources that we use to come to our conclusions.
Right. Because, you know, I mean, it's an appropriate part of the process, but when people receive a report like this, the first thing they want to know is, how did you come to these recommendations? And I think that if we tell them up front, here are the things we did and learned about and reviewed and understood to come to these recommendations, then...
Specifically, just thinking about mine in particular, which isn't necessarily applicable to the other infrastructure ones, but in the streets, we had a breakout of where the status was and our thoughts on the 2011 Infrastructure Task Force recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
Where would you foresee that being inserted in this?
That is sort of an anomalous, yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's not necessarily applicable to the other ones.
What would you do? Could that be a subtable in the recommendations, in the main recommendations section under streets and transportation?
Transportation E, you know, just
pull that as its own.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure.
And maybe get some of the narrative down by, you know, literally sort of putting it in a table. Here's this 2011 recommendation. Here's our reaction, like that, so that it's... very clearly tied.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
So it would have an extra, essentially, bullet segment then that the others don't.
They are all, the drafts are all necessarily, I think, a little bit different. Other comments or thoughts?
I don't know that that's necessarily a bad thing, as long as it's got some reasonable concepts you get. I think what we've talked about before is that you get a narrative, you get a discussion and a list of recommendations. I mean, I think if you keep that kind of general format, even though it might be slightly different looking,
right.
It's probably okay, because like you said, 90% of the people aren't going to drill down to that lower area. They're going to stay right up the top in the executive summary.
It also does somewhat show that this was not a administrative, formal, pre-laid-out process either. It was a number of citizens with no more interest than just wanting to see Columbia do things better.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's okay that it's a little...
Yeah, the only thing that I think that we could seek support from the admin staff for water and light would be to have take the individual ones and make sure they're right in the right format as far as chapters and spacing and lettering and all that.
Right.
But as far as content, the content and the flow of the content may be slightly different, but as long as it looks familiar, then it would be okay.
And I think it might have been when you were on vacation, but Jen laid it out really well, the timeline, so that built into our last weeks of meetings, we have given plenty of time to get our draft to staff to do that kind of formatting piece.
Yep.
And we'll have... relevant departments read before we release it to the public. Make sure that we haven't made any misstatements as far as some of the presentations and things.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, I think so too.
Thank you. John, do you think that you'd be able to work that into the formatting process? And by the way, I had not anticipated that staff would help us with formatting a final report, and I really appreciate that. I'd anticipated some late nights, so thank you.
I just want to make sure, so, I mean, we're going to include Erin's PowerPoint or whatever, but if we pull out anything we remember from her report and it's wrong,
right.
She has the chance to say, I don't think I would have said that way, or whatever.
Yeah. We can just get you a draft and you can determine how to review
that
it.
That's how you want it.
Thank you. All right. But good point, Kim, about review. All right, anything else? I want to let people know, and I will apologize up front, so I will be here next week virtually, not literally. Not for the minutes, but we initially were going to fly on a trip and decided to drive instead, and in the interim, we scheduled this meeting, and it's one where we're having a guest, and I didn't want to, I think, better than changing anybody else's plan. I've already talked to Jeff, and I'll WebEx into it, and I think it'll be just fine, but I wanted you to know I won't be here in person. And I'm sort of sad. I'm looking forward to next week's meeting, but Colorado will be nice, too.
There's places where they don't have internet service there. Just like.
I'm for sure that I will not be in one of those places on Tuesday night. But yeah.
I would be.
Okay. Any other comments by folks here? 8:56. Yay.
That's a new record.
That's a new record.